couple of questions for you. Why do the keypads on drive-up cash machines have braille dots? These are drive-up cash machines, and yet you've noticed them. They have dots for the blind. Here's another one. Why do brides spend a small fortune on gowns they're only going to wear once, while grooms just go out and they and the whole male party rent tuxes? Why one is a purchase, a massive purchase, and the other is a rental? For decades, economist Robert Frank has been asking his economic students at Cornell University to pose and answer questions like these as a way of learning how economic principles actually operate in the real world, which they do, everywhere, all the time. Students have to write an essay explaining such everyday occurrences and oddities in economic terms. Well, after years of collecting these, Frank picked the best of the thousands of essays that his students had turned in, and we're talking about students from freshman year to PhD candidates, and he combined those with some of his own examples to create a book, The Economic Naturalist, In Search of Explanations for Everyday Enigmas. And he hopes and suspects that this book will help people retain basic economic principles better than an introductory course. Another book that's just out, that book is The Economic Naturalist. Another book just out by Robert Frank is called Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. Now, although middle-income families don't earn much more than they did several decades ago, they're buying bigger cars, bigger houses, bigger appliances, the newest high-tech gadgets. They're moving into neighborhoods to get better schools, and to pay for them, they spend more than they earn. They carry record levels of debt. Today, on the news, there was an announcement of that's the thing that is rising the fastest in this economy right now is consumer debt. So, in the book Falling Behind, Robert Frank explores the very meaning of happiness and prosperity in America today and explains how increased concentrations of income and wealth at the top of the economic pyramid have set off kind of trickle-down expenditures for the less well-off and thus putting themselves, as I said, into enormous debt. Robert Frank is a professor of management and professor of economics at the Johnson Graduate School of Management, Cornell University. His Economic Scene column appears monthly in the New York Times. He's the author of Choosing the Right Pond, The Winner-Take-All Society, Luxury Fever, The Economic Naturalist, and the newest, Falling Behind. Robert Frank, welcome.
Nice to be with you, Terry.
Okay. Let's start off just by answering those first two questions that may have piqued people's curiosity. Why do keypads at drive-in ATMs have braille dots? And why do brides buy their gowns while grooms rent their tuxes?
Those two are actually two of my favorite questions of all time. The first one was submitted by my student, Bill Joa. And his suggested answer was that the manufacturing companies are going to make the machines with braille dots on the keypads for their walk-up locations in any event. Once they've got themselves set up to make those machines, he reasoned, it's just quicker and easier to make one kind of machine rather than hold two separate inventories and worry about getting the right ones to the right destinations. That might be worth doing if the drivers suffered any inconvenience as a result of the braille dots on the keypads, but they clearly don't. So it's just cheaper and easier to do it all the same way. That was a good answer. Took less than a page. That story's been told, I'm sure, by his classmates and their successors thousands of times when they went home to visit with their families. It's just another way of getting the cost-benefit way of thinking drilled into your head in a much more intuitive form than it would be if it came in through an equation or a graph.
Right. And as you referred there to the economic principle that everyday situation deals with, which is cost-benefit analysis.
That's right.
It might be the same.
The second question you mentioned.
Yeah.
Sorry, the second question you mentioned is also a nice illustration of the cost-benefit principle. I'll just elaborate briefly on the question. What makes it even more interesting is that the bride spends thousands of dollars knowing full well she'll never wear the dress again, While the groom, who sure he'll have scores of occasions in the future to wear formal wear, rents a cheap suit. What's going on here? The interesting questions are the ones that have that element of paradox about them. It just seems that it's the bride who ought to be renting and the groom who should be buying here. That one was submitted by Jennifer Dulski in 1997. She had gotten married 6 months before and I imagine had pondered the very question in her experience. And so what her suggested answer was that if you think about big social occasions like weddings, it's more important for women, she argued, to make a fashion statement than it is for men. That's an assumption. You could argue with it, but most people seem to accept it at face value. It seems to describe the situation in most countries. If you'll take that opening assumption at face value, then what it implies about the rental business is pretty interesting. If you wanted to make a fashion statement in a rental gown, the company would have to hold on stock, 50, 75, 100 gowns in each size to give you enough choice to feel you could do that. The gowns would rent out every 5, 6, 7 years. The cost of carrying that idle inventory would be so high they'd have to charge 110, 115% of the purchase price as a rental fee. And if they did that, nobody would rent. They'd all buy. The guys, if they're willing to wear the same style suit everyone else wears, they don't care, apparently, the rental company can stock 2 or 3 suits in each size. They turn over 6, 7 times a year. The rental rate for the suit then is as low as 20, 25% of the purchase price of the suit. And if you're trying to save a few bucks on that occasion, there's a good chance to do it.
So okay.
It's a nice explanation. It's coherent. It's a narrative. You can get your mind around it. What we know, Terry, is that narratives slide into the brain like a key into a lock. When we teach the traditional freshman course in economics, there are 1,000 different ideas thrown out there for students, many of them embedded in the form of equations and graphs. And the human mind just doesn't absorb information that efficiently in that format. So what we know, unfortunately, is that after 6 months, if students are given tests that probe their knowledge of basic economic principles, the ones who took the course don't score any better than the ones who never took it at all. That's pretty low bar to beat, I think. I think if we can get them telling economic stories, they're going to do better than that.
Well, I think this is quite interesting, and it's what I noticed in your answers was you didn't merely answer the question. You answered the question and actually gave a little critique of the explanation itself. You actually are contributing part of the proceeds of the book to the writing program at Cornell?
This writing assignment that I've given my students for the last 15 years or so grew out of a program I participated in the early 80s. It was the Knight Institute's sponsored program at Cornell for writing in the disciplines. Their belief was that the best way to learn about an idea is to write about it, so that the only writing courses shouldn't be the freshman writing seminar or the English courses that you take, but you should actually write about the ideas you're trying to learn in the disciplines. And so they gave me a teaching assistant to help with the grading. And I assigned 20-page papers, which once I lost my TA began to shrink in size. I kept them, though, because I could tell that the students got much more engaged with the subject matter when they were writing about it.
Okay, and I would guess—
Now the papers are only a page long, and they're better still. You know, they're crisp. They think about an interesting question. You know, I insist to them that I don't want to read the answer to their question if the question itself isn't interesting. So, you know, they've got to think about a lot of things they're looking at when they walk around in the world to come up with an interesting question. And then once they've done that, though, they're on their way. They'll put a lot of energy into coming up with an economically plausible account for what's going on in this seeming paradox. And the results are they've got things to talk about with friends and family and argue about. And each time they tell the story, it just gets a little bit more firm in their mind, the underlying principle.
Right. Now, you mentioned the research that was done on conventional economic teaching and the lack of retention. How about have you tested the retention based on this use of narrative?
You know, that's exactly the right question to pose, and I wish I could show you a voluminous data set where we'd proven conclusively that this really does work in the way I think it does. We're working on designing the set of questions that would satisfy economists that if students can answer these, that means they've retained what we really care about. So I hope to have an answer to that question before too long. But in the meantime, what I can tell you anecdotally is that students have been coming back for reunion. Oh, every year I'll see a set of former students. They'll come by my office just to say hello. And in so many cases, they'll say, I've got this great question I thought up, and what do you think of this answer to it? You know, so they're out there. They're still thinking about the things they run into in their everyday experience, trying to apply their basic economic principles to them. If they're doing that, you know, I don't think they're losing ground as the years go by. I think they're getting better at economics.
Okay.
But we'll see once we have the formal test. You asked a good question.
Right. I must say that you've tapped into one of my passions, making the distinction between learning by pie charts and graphs versus learning by story. I actually speak about this and teach this. And so I'm going to get on my soapbox for a moment and just emphasize what you're saying. It's a matter of history that basically we learned everything that helped us survive and helped our cultures of our various clans and tribes survive by storytelling. There was no other way to pass on the essential information. So in some sense, our brains might even be hardwired for that. That, as I say, if you look at a child, you start telling them stories, which most good parents do, and they pretty quickly, once they can speak, and probably even before they can speak, start telling stories to their stuffed animals, to their imaginary friends, or they tell their own stories back to you. And you'll notice it's years before they start using abstract logic and numbers and that sort of thing. And I sort of say that storytelling is our native language. Your thoughts?
You know, That's right on target, Terry. The learning theorist Jerome Bruner, he's a psychologist, very distinguished psychologist, and he's been a pioneer in the narrative theory of learning research. And he's written that if a child doesn't capture an experience in narrative form, if he doesn't sort of embed it in a story, then it's just not available to him later on. He can't dredge it up from memory and mull it over and think about it and learn from it. It's just lost. If the experience is coded in story form, then it's accessible. He can bring it up when a similar experience occurs to him and sort of compare this one to that one and make his decisions in the light of what he learned the last time. And the evolutionary psychologists agree completely with your characterization of it. We evolved as storytellers. You know, we didn't squat down and start drawing graphs and equations with a stick in the sand. You know, we just told each other stories. That's how the brain is wired to receive information. It just gets in there naturally that way. Now, I don't want to make that a wrap against technical analysis and following through the full implications of the logical sequences. No, I mean, we've made enormous progress by our ability to go beyond narrative. But if you're trying to learn the guts of a few simple ideas for the first time, why swim upstream? Why not go with the natural strength of the brain, which is the narrative structure? If you can get those ideas wrapped into a story with actors, a plot, something that has a noticeable flow of events that people can wrap their minds around, then they're not going to have to struggle to comprehend the idea. It's just going to be part of them without effort almost.
Okay. And listeners, if you thought what you were going to get was just economic theory today, this piece that Robert and I are talking about right now, I think, is going to be really valuable to you. A metaphor to think about, if you are in the business in your personal or professional life of imparting information to your workers, to your colleagues, etc., maybe even to your spouse, then think of it as a necklace. And if the facts that you want someone to remember are the beads, the story is the string. And you take this, you know, you disconnect the string of a string of pearls and you've got chaos. But as long as it's together, you've got something that holds it together and keeps it working for you. Let me ask you, you say that there are basically 4, 5, 6 maybe principal ideas in economics. Can I ask you briefly to illustrate each of them with a brief reference to an anecdote, and then we will go to talking about falling behind and the effect of rising fortunes of the rich on the static fortunes of the middle class.
Okay, here I'm going to step in and suggest that since we only do have a limited amount of time, it might be better to do a couple of principles well than
Great.
To do
exactly.
five or six.
Okay, so
hurry.
You're going to pick a couple, and
so,
then
so,
folks...
Yeah, I'll sort of work my way down the list, and we'll see how far
okay,
we get.
Okay, very good.
The cost-benefit principle is by far the most important one. You could almost say that all the other ones are derivative of it.
And we've already illustrated that one with a couple.
And that one's shown up already in the two examples we've discussed. So, no real problem wrapping your mind around that one for most people. But, you know, the details matter. I mean, to apply it correctly in context is not always that easy. So another important principle, let me pose a question. We'll see what we can do to answer it. Why my student Jonathan Chang wanted to know, are brown eggs more expensive than white ones? That's true here anyway. He cited data from our local supermarket that brown eggs, grade A, large, were 79 cents a dozen more than white ones. And that's interesting. And typically, economists use the supply and demand model to try and answer questions about why things cost what they do. And there's a principle that I call the no cash on the table principle. That means that there shouldn't be an easy opportunity for somebody who doesn't bring some special talent or willingness to work hard to the table to just walk away with extra cash that's just lying around. If markets are working, all the easy opportunities will have been taken up. So the explanation we want to offer for why brown eggs sell for more than white eggs shouldn't violate this no cash on the table principle. If brown eggs cost the same to produce as white eggs, we'd have a paradox because then the question would be, well, why are producers even offering white eggs? They could make more money by producing only brown eggs. And since the cost, if you assume the cost is the same of the two kinds of eggs, since the brown eggs sell for more, they'd have higher profits. So it can't be true, if you believe in the no cash on the table principle, that the two eggs cost the same to produce, he reasoned. And so he did some digging and found that, sure enough, the eggs laid by hens that have brown shells are typically laid by bigger hens than the hens that lay white eggs. The bigger hens eat more. It costs the poultry farmers more to produce each egg, therefore. And so the cost of production of brown eggs is higher. Well, then the question is, why do consumers pay extra for brown eggs if they taste the same and have the same nutritional content? And there's no ready answer, but unless consumers were willing to pay more, the two eggs couldn't sell for different colors because consumers would buy only white eggs.
Right.
Case. Some consumers must think brown eggs are better. Maybe they're wrong, or maybe they just like the looks of brown eggs. I'm embarrassed to say we buy brown eggs. So I feel like I know enough to think, hey, what am I getting here? I'm not getting a premium product. Why am I paying extra? I think my wife likes the look of the brown eggs.
I'm wondering if on that one, because I love the fact that you choose an example of which you actually still end up with a mystery. But maybe part of it is the very fact that there are less of them because and they cost more make people think there's something to it.
Yeah, maybe the mere fact that they're more expensive makes people think they're getting a premium product. But in fact, they are kind of pretty, and you know, nobody box when somebody's willing to pay more for a hotel room with a nice view than
right.
for a room on the other side that looks out at the alleyway. So if you think they're prettier, that's fine if you're willing to pay more for them.
Right, and my guess is they also have a core that people assume. This would be my guess that people assume they're more natural. That would just be my guess. And so, you know.
Yeah, no, that's an association. Brown rice is better for you than white rice.
Mm-hmm.
So why not here too?
Right. Okay. I'll tell you what.
That could be.
At this point, let's skip to The other book, because I think people are getting the sense now of what we're talking about with the economic naturalist is looking at the real world and asking real world questions, finding economic answers for them in a way that is in narrative form. So if this has been at all interesting to you, the book is The Economic Naturalist, In Search of Explanations for Everyday Enigmas. And as we've talked about, if you, like 99% of other people, remember things better when they're told in story form, this will be your chance to finally master some of the economics that slipped through your brain over the years. Now, falling behind, it seems to me, is an interesting analysis of a phenomenon that has been taking place in the U.S. over the last few years, really coming to sharp relief as the top 1%, top 5%, top 10% seem to be getting enormous gains, economic gains, in both salaries and wealth, while the middle class, the working class, seem to be making occasionally minor increases and then falling back and so on, almost a static line for the last few years. And yet what you're saying is that doesn't just affect the very rich, it affects the middle class, even though they haven't really lost relative to where they themselves were. Is that a good setup?
Yeah, that's a good summary of the main theme of the book. And it's not quite correct to say they haven't lost, because I think they have lost something very important. Even though, as we conventionally measure their purchasing power, they seem to have a little bit more now than they did 30 years ago. I think some of the basic goals that most middle-class families are trying to achieve are harder to achieve in the current environment than they used to be.
Okay, one of the things that I often...
So in that sense, I think they have lost.
Yeah, I say in that regard that people do seem to be able to buy the newest, electronic gadget, but things like healthcare, college education, and their own home get harder and harder, the things that made this country what it is in the 50s.
That's right. And so, yeah, if you're a parent, your main concern is you want your kids to get a good start. You want to make sure you buy a house in a safe neighborhood with good schools. The cost of doing that relative to your income is vastly higher now than it was 30 years ago. And in the book, I argue that the primary reason for that is that the real gains in income have occurred almost exclusively at the very top of the income ladder. You mentioned the top 1, the top 10, the top 20%. If you go beyond the top 20%, you don't see much in the way of significant gains. But the really important story is that the big gains have not been in the top 1%, but in the top 0.1%. And even higher up, we see more spectacular gains. It's been a real pyramiding of income and wealth the last 30 years.
I know. And one of the things that often when one looks at economic numbers in the press and so on, very often everything is aggregated. So, when they say incomes have increased, when they say wealth has increased, when they say the GDP has increased, it's just these huge numbers that...
It's the average.
Exactly.
Yeah. But that doesn't tell you what's happened to the guy in the middle. The median family earns about the same as it did 30 years ago. A little bit more, but not much more.
Yeah, the statistic I often say, let me ask you this, Robert. The statistic I often say, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that real earnings for Americans rose steadily from World War II to 1973, and basically 73 to 2007, which now puts us at a lot of years, that increase has been minor, if at all.
That's right. Yeah, you've nailed it. It was 3% a year for everybody, rich, poor, middle, alike. In the post-war years, those three decades were a good high-growth, even-growth period. Since the early 70s, probably maybe even a few years before that it started, virtually all the significant gains have gone to the top.
And so
that's had practical consequences for people in the middle.
Right. So if I give you like 2 minutes to really tell us the key important things that you want people to get out of falling behind, what would those be?
Well, I'd say, first of all, don't get angry at the rich for buying lavish things. Everybody in every circle has a different frame of reference. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Nepal, and I lived in a house that people would be ashamed to live in here. I thought it was a great house when I was living in Nepal. if people in Nepal could see my house here, which is not an elaborate house by American standards by any means, they would think I'd totally lost my senses. Why would anyone need such a house, they'd say. So spending is very local. Standards are local. So the rich have more money. Of course they're buying bigger mansions. That's just what people do when they get more money. They buy bigger and better. The people in the middle aren't angry about that. They think they'll be rich or hope they'll be rich someday, so they like to see pictures of the mansions. The people just below the top, though, are influenced by the bigger mansions. Now, it might be somebody just below the top wanted to build 40,000 square feet himself but was embarrassed to do it. Now, somebody richer built 70,000 square feet. He's free to build his 40,000 square foot house and won't even attract any complaints from it. Or it may be that the richest people now have such big houses, they've started having their daughters' wedding receptions in the home. And now we need to be able to do that, too, because we travel in the same circle. We need to build bigger. And then there's a layer just below us, and they need to build bigger. Now the median home is about a third bigger than it was in 1980. And there's been no gain in income. Why has it gotten bigger? The simplest hypothesis is that it's because of that cascade of expenditures launched in the first instance by spending at the top. And
okay.
The rub for the median family is they can't afford the median house any longer, and that's the house you need to buy if you want your kids to go to at least average quality schools. So you either go into debt, take your savings down to nothing, commute longer distances, work longer hours, all these margins people are working to try to make basic ends meet to achieve the goal that every family wants to achieve, get your kids into a decent school.
Okay. Having used that big example of housing and schools and so on, I think you can get the sense of what we're talking about here. And I'm just going to make one statement, and then I've got to close, and I just want your agreement with this. It struck me as we were talking that if credit cards and the huge credit industry had not come along in these 30 years when wages for the middle and working classes have stayed static, we might have had a lot more social unrest in this country.
You know, I think the ability to borrow sometimes forces you to borrow. So I think if you're trying to keep up and others are spending more and they're spending more because they can borrow, that puts pressure on you to do likewise.
And so you don't notice.
Every time there was a, I think if there hadn't been that ready access to credit, we'd have actually been better off.
That's what I'm saying, is that you don't notice it quite the same, and that both those things have moved in parallel. So again, the books are The Economic Naturalist and Falling Behind. The website is robert-h-frank.com. Robert Frank, keep up the good and interesting work.
Thanks, Terry.
Okay.
Look forward to talking to you again.
Great.